Hello and welcome to Viking Age Environments. I'm Rebecca Boyd and today I'm going to be talking to Ingar Gundersen, who is an archaeologist in the Cultural History Museum in Oslo. In this, we're going a little bit before the start of the Viking Age, where we're delving back into the Iron Age in Scandinavia and looking at events that happened in the 6th century AD. This is the Fimbulwinter theory, the idea that there is evidence for a series of volcanic eruptions in the 530s. This coincides with textual records, which document the darkening of the sun, an outbreak of the Justinian plague, and consequent famine. Ingar's work looks at the archaeological data for these events in the 6th century in Norway specifically. And he has used a combination of environmental approaches, of data modelling practices and interpretive models and theories to build a new and much more detailed picture of these human-environment interactions in the 6th century. Let's hear Ingar introduce himself and tell us a little bit about his archaeological background and why he became so interested in this 6th century climatic event.
So maybe to start with, could you tell me a little bit about your own background and work as an archaeologist?
Sure. Well, it's almost 20 years ago since I started studying archaeology at the University in Oslo. And I also had this exchange semester in Cardiff University in Wales. And I was doing my master thesis and handed in 2007. Then started doing rescue archaeology throughout southern Norway, actually. Also did some excavations around England, Greece, Sweden, Russia and stuff. And after a while settled at the University of Oslo and the Museum of Cultural History, where I'm still now situated. And when I was doing this rescue archaeology, I had this project up in this one of the major valleys in eastern Norway called Gudbrandsdalen Valley. But actually, there had been almost no archaeological excavations previously before we got there. It was in 2011. So we had kind of little knowledge about the archaeology in the valley. And at the same time, we knew there had to be something there because we had some huge monumental burial mounds at some of the sites. So we knew there had to be something, but we didn't know exactly what. And we started excavating, and after a while, we found it because it was buried underneath these huge deposits of floods and landslides. That was quite new to all of us because no similar complexes had been found in eastern Norway up to that date. And underneath these sediments, we found this Iron Age and even Bronze Age settlements and agricultural layers and stuff. And we got this whole new picture of how actually prehistory had been in this valley. As I guess it was more or less then I realized the importance of environmental factors for settlement development and also societal development in Iron Age Scandinavia. So I started working more on it, reading a little and trying to figure out if I could work it into a PhD project, which I ultimately did. But in the meantime, I was more and more curious about the 6th century cooling that was becoming a popular hypothesis in Scandinavian archaeology at the time, especially through the works of Bo Greslund and Neil Price, and a few others, of course. And then I found, okay, there's a connection here, actually. Even not just that I did see major changes in the settlement record in Gudbrandsdalen Valley around this time, which might indicate there might be a connection. But also these floods that they were excavating were also dated approximately the same time. So this climatic factor became more and more interesting. And that's, I started actually digging more into it and wanted to do a PhD project on it. But when reading on it, I kind of found what I termed the Fimbulwinter hypothesis somewhat inadequate because it was highly interesting and has great potential, but in a way it wasn't actually really substantiated or had any kind of analytical framework that could be used to actually get more knowledge in the direct impact of the cooling of the pioneer societies. Everybody just believed it had to be the case that a profound cooling necessarily would impact the Scandinavian societies, but nobody actually asked why this would have to be the case. So I started reading about disasters and catastrophes in anthropology and found this concept of vulnerability quite interesting because it explained to me that it wasn't actually the cooling itself that was important. It's more, it was the character of the society it affected. And whether it affected the society, of course, depends on how society is constituted. What is their subsistence strategies, for instance, and how densely populated are they, for instance? So that's when all this, my current works actually started to, develop itself.
Thank you. That's really interesting. We have all these grand frameworks of things like the 6th century crisis and, you know, the arrival of towns. But what I really think about is, it's exactly that. It's the character of society that experiences these. You know, we have to tie all these frameworks down into what actually happened on the ground and to the data that we see and try to understand it in terms of people's lives, rather than just these wonderful theoretical frameworks that that conceptually I find quite hard to understand sometimes. You know, for me, it is about people's experiences. And that's the joy of archaeology, that we're talking about people's lives. And I think it's a real privilege that we get to do that. But that absolutely we have to start with the data as well, looking to see what is there and then building up from that.
I think we need to acknowledge the complexity of the archaeological record, you know. And because when I started looking into this hypothesis of the Fimbul winter and stuff and looked at the Norwegian archaeological record, I didn't actually get it to fit. In some cases, it seemed like a probable explanation for the changes we see in the record. But in other cases, actually, it didn't make any real sense. And Greslund and Price, they have this, they suggested that 50% of the population in present-day Norway and Sweden perished during this 6th century crisis. It may be in some areas, I don't know, but in some areas it might seem that you have this huge catastrophe and the south will decline and everything. But I started looking at the Oslo Fjord, for instance, in eastern Norway. It was hard to actually say something similar at all. It seemed quite different. Okay. So I do think that this 6th century is a major turning point in Scandinavian prehistory, but not necessarily in an all-out crisis for all regions.
Yeah.
Because now it depends on how dependent were they on agriculture in the first place? And secondly, what kind of agriculture were they actually doing? Was it just cereals, for instance, which would be highly vulnerable to climate cooling? Or could it also be more emphasis on pastoralism, for instance, and livestock? And the latter case would be less affected of the cooling. Although some even think that livestock might have been seriously affected as well, but it's more like, also a hypothesis, we have nothing to substantiate it with it yet. So unable to get any further with these perspectives, you need to be more analytical, I think. You need to develop analytical frameworks that we can use to actually kind of deconstruct all these processes and see what really did happen and why did they manage so well and the others perished perhaps. So it merges a complex picture of human environmental dynamics, I think.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make it any more easy at all, by far. But it makes it a lot more interesting.
Yeah. I suppose maybe would you just explain what the concept of Fimbul winter is, what this theory is, kind of in layman's terms?
Yeah, sure. It's a story about the great catastrophes and volcanic eruptions and everything. Well, of course, it's very well funded, the cooling itself, from a geoscientific perspective, because throughout the globe in glaciers we have here my bad English comes into play. What do you call it? These tephra layers in the glaciers, which are from volcanic eruptions from throughout the globe, going back thousands of years. And around the year 536 and 540, we have these same deposits all around the globe in different glaciers, which can actually have chemical fingerprints that then we use to trace them back to a certain volcano or a certain region. So we know for sure that major eruptions happened in 536 and 540. They might have surpassed anything we know about from historical times, including the 1815 Tambora eruption, which is more or less the biggest eruption we know about in historical times. During Tambora, tens of thousands of people died in the near vicinity of the volcano just within a matter of weeks because of the tephra deposits and the gases and stuff. And also in Europe, we had a huge in Central and Western Europe, several accounts of crop failure and famine, starvation and everything, poor people moving around begging for food. So we know that these kind of events might have had great consequences for human societies throughout the globe, because we haven't had this really explosive eruption. So you get this the plumes, if they're going high enough into the stratosphere, they're creating this aerosol veil that is blocking the radiance of the sun, that's causing the cooling at the surface. So, of course, it has the potential of heavily affecting, in particular, cereal production and cultivation. But at the same time, these aerosol veils, they're not uniform. They're not, their morphological characteristics, they change both our long spatial and temporal scales. They might be very thick at some spots at certain times, but not during other times. So it changes, and it can last for several years. So it's not easy to say that if you have crop failure at one place, it not necessarily is the same at another place, even with the same continent, like Europe, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And we also see that in 1815, after the Tambora eruption, when you have these huge famines in Czech Republic, for instance, and in England and France and stuff, but actually in Norway, which is much closer to the agricultural limit, you know, there is no actually evidence for crop failure around that time. And we do know that from farm diaries from that period that actually tell that they experienced extreme weather phenomena and cool summers and everything. And the farmers themselves, they actually were worried about the crops might fail in 1815 and 1816, but they didn't.
Okay, so that's really interesting.
That's actually, it's not necessarily a catastrophe just because they have a volcanic eruption at another side of the globe. That is also the thing, I think, with the 536 and 540 events, that of course it had an impact throughout the globe, but we can't say from that starting point that it had an impact everywhere around the globe. So that's when we need to start contextualizing the evidence. You know? We start contextualizing the scientific evidence. What do we know about the cooling itself? Was it as bad in Scandinavia, for instance, as it was in Central Europe? And secondly, as I said previously, how dependent were society on cultivation in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
So then all this complexity starts to emerge that is really fascinating, but takes a lot of time to dig into. And but the thing that is different with 536 and 540 is that we have two or three eruptions so close in time that might have caused a prolonged cooling that is significantly different from what we see after Tambora in 1815 and stuff. Mm-hmm. And this prolonged cooling would, of course, increase the danger for affecting more societies over time. So actually, I do think that it heavily affected Scandinavian Irish societies in some ways. But to understand how much, how deep the impact was, you know, we need to be more analytical than we have been so far. Of course, when we're talking about the Fimbul winter, of course, I should mention as well, you know, that this Norse myths about the Fimbul winter and the Ragnarok is a popular idea now, that this is the cause, that, you know, the 6th century cooling is the origin of these Norse myths. And it seems actually quite probable when you read about it, you know, this long cooling, 3 years with no summers in between and stuff. No, it sounds quite probable.
It does,
there are a few scientists that actually argue that that the myth is more colored by the Icelandic volcanic landscape of the 10th century than it is of the 6th century, for instance.
Really?
So we can't be quite positive about it either. But
would you say that either the 6th century or the 10th century probably is those volcanic eruptions are the origins of the Ragnarok myth? That impact, whether it was in the 6th century or the 10th century.
I would say it's probably, I would probably say it's both, actually. You know, how these myths that change during the centuries, and it doesn't take much for one myth to actually be developed into something more when we move it to a different cultural context, which the Icelandic landscape is. So I think it's kind of both, actually. But still it's kind of out of my league to discuss the old myths. Though. But that's why I've termed this the Fimbul winter hypothesis, because you have all these mythological aspects baked into this grand idea of climate cooling and societal decline and stuff.
Absolutely. So I suppose in terms of what people experienced in 536, 540, you know, the impact of the eruptions, is that, you know, that's a significant drop in temperature? You know, do they, very simply, do they need to wear more clothes? Do they suddenly need to try and supply themselves with more furs for warmth, for blankets? Does it have kind of an immediate economic impact, do you think? People suddenly need things that they didn't need before because of the drop in temperature. Do you have any ideas on that?
That's the thing with the 6th century. That's not the climate cooling is not the only thing happening. You know, we have the short time before, you have the breakdown of the Western Roman Empire, and with it, you also have this breakdown in trade relations in Europe.
Yeah,
which is particularly disastrous for southern Scandinavia, which were highly dependent on this trade, or, you know, the flow of gold from Roman Empire up to the barbarian societies.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if we look into the written sources from the Mediterranean, we see that there are several accounts of actually people experiencing this cold period. They even witnessed, you know, the darkening of the sun, for instance, which might be quite disturbing to think to watch if you are superstitious as well.
Yeah.
And of course they were.
Yeah.
So this was a bad omen, and there were accounts of, you know, grapes that wouldn't mature, you know, the grapes were sour and stuff. And we also have a few written accounts on crop failures. I think it is in, is it northern Italy, I think? But in the same account, you also have, they also say that they dispatched, you know, grains to this area which experienced crop failure, you know, to help them out. And that's, that tells us that what is crop failure in one area is not necessarily crop failure in another, because they actually could dispatch the surplus grains to this. So even there you see huge differences. But you know from the geoscientific climate simulations that the cooling was probably worse actually around the Mediterranean than in Scandinavia. It might have dropped perhaps with 3 degrees, you know, in the Mediterranean, and perhaps just 1 degree in Scandinavia. But of course, 1 degree can be more critical in Scandinavia than 3 degrees in the Mediterranean. The reporter did experience it, but they couldn't actually relate to it, what it actually was. And no idea, what, because the eruptions were away in Mesoamerica and Northern America. Now they have no actually direct knowledge about the causes. But of course, it wouldn't change their needs, immediate needs. But also in Mediterranean, they have at the same time the reconquest, you know, of the Western Roman Empire by the Eastern Roman Empire, for instance. There are warfare going on, there are migrations, there are huge geopolitical developments going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to say, when we see this decline in the Scandinavian record, if it's just about the cooling, or is it also about trade relations, for instance, political relations, and that kind of stuff. But if we talk, if we focus just on the cooling, of course, if crop did fail, of course they would need to find some other kind of resources to rely on. And that is the thing with Eastern Norway in particular. They have huge outfield resources. They are, and as early as the 4th century AD, they have this quite intensive exploitation of outfield resources, both when it comes to iron, but also wild deer, for instance, for furs and for meat and for animals and stuff. And these resources will probably have increased in importance if the crops failed. And in other words, they had other resources to rely on. But the question is if they actually did. So what I did was I compiled all the C14 evidence we had from hunting and trapping sites in this part of eastern Norway to see if there was any kind of increase during the 6th century and the late Iron Age. But actually, there wasn't.
Oh, no.
So actually, I don't know.
There was
a slight decrease.
Really?
So of course then they can say, okay, maybe they just died and nobody was hunting. That's also a possibility. But it kind of confused me, because I expected it to be an increase.
Yeah.
So that was the question. Okay, maybe crops didn't fail at all. So I did this GIS modeling when I took the the required temperature sum of all the cereals have different requirements, you know. And for instance, wheat is the most heat demanding, so that's a vulnerable species if you have a climate cooling. But the Scandinavians, they didn't care that much about wheat. They had some wheat, but it's not the most important grain species in Scandinavia was barley. And barley is more cold resistant than wheat is. This, of course, still has certain requirements. So what I did, I took this GIS modeling and made this terrain model where I calculating the local, of course, I need to say that this temperature requirements for barley, it changes at different latitudes, actually. It's not the same as southern Norway as it's in northern Norway.
Yeah, depending on how far you go.
Because of the midnight sun in summertime. If you don't have more sun hours, then you need less degrees for the cereals to mature. Exactly. So we have to calculate this requirements for every part of Norway. So it's quite exhausting, but it's quite fun as well. But, and then you can use this input data in a GIS model and see, okay, how much could I lower the temperature before the cultivated lands doesn't reach the required temperature sum? So I found out in the Gudbrandsdalen Valley that I was working with previously, you have to have a degree temperature reduction of -2 to -3 degrees for situations to become critical.
Okay.
And that is quite probable scenario for the 6th century cooling. But then I moved to Oslofjord area and did the same there. And actually, a 3-degree cooling had no effect. So just within Eastern Norway, you have huge regional differences. Not just because of sun hours and temperature, but also due to precipitation. Because precipitation is important. The more precipitation you have, the more temperatures you need for the cereals to mature. And in Norway, you have huge differences in precipitation. Eastern Norway is quite dry. Western Norway is quite like Ireland. It's wet all the time, you know? I remember when I lived in Cardiff, you know, it was raining almost every day. And that is more or less like it is in Western Norway. So they did a third modeling of the southwestern part of Norway. And there I got 2 and 3 degrees decline would be quite critical as well, just like in Gudbrandsdalen Valley. Even though the temperatures are the same in Oslo for the area, the precipitation is so much higher that actually a cooling would be critical. And if you look into the archaeological record from these areas in the southwestern Norway, it's actually probably the best example we have of a possible crisis during the 6th century is in southwestern Norway. We have lots of evidence for site abandonment, you know, failing crops and stuff. Well, in Oslofjord area, we have actually no convincing evidence of site abandonment or societal failure. So I think it kind of makes sense that So by testing the Fimbulvetr hypothesis by using certain criteria like vulnerability, it's easier to disentangle the processes and actually...
Yeah. The complexity.
Move a little further in our conclusion. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The complexity of that. The devil is in the details. And
That's really interesting. That there's such variation just within Norway, never mind the rest of Scandinavia, the rest of the world, that you can track that. That's really cool. I like that.
But what's confusing me is though the cooling should be critical in Gudbrandsdalen Valley. Still, there's no increase in outfield exploitation. So that kind of confused me a little. So I don't know how to solve it yet, but I will have to during the next 4 months.
Yes, you will. You will solve it.
Hopefully. I also did some pollen coring. I was cooperating with this pollenologist. He is retired now, so he's now not charging that much for his analysis. So we went up to Gudbrandsdalen Valley, had a pollen coring in a bog, and started to analyze it. And actually, we did find that there was probably crop failure in this area around that time, around the 6th century.
Okay.
So it might have works well with the GIS modeling.
Yeah.
So I think there was a cooling, and I think there was crop failure, at least for Gudbrandsdalen Valley's part, but not necessarily for Oslofjord, for instance.
Yeah. It's crop failure and population decline, you think?
Yeah, I guess so. Probably it would have been. Major societal upheavals, perhaps. I guess a situation like that, even if it only affects a number of people, not society at whole, it would create some kind of societal instability. some kind of unrest, which needs to be handled. And the depopulation is part of that scenario. As these are societies that didn't have the possibilities like modern societies to actually mitigate, provide help, for instance. They were more relied on themselves, on the local resources they had.
Yeah, more self-sufficient.
So I think it might have sparked off, or at least been a catalyst for societal processes that were perhaps already underway, but I think it might have enforced it and entrenched society in a more, how do they say it in English, society became probably more stratified. Because what we see after 6th century in Scandinavia, we have this emergence of this great new dynasties, which probably had regional powers than the previous dynasties of the earlier Iron Age. We see that the society is changing. And actually, when we're talking about Viking Age in Scandinavia, is it being the big thing?
Yeah.
It's actually kind of misplaced, because actually the process begins in the 6th century.
Yeah.
So what we see in the Viking Age is only the culmination of what begins a few centuries
what has happened
in what we call the Merovingian period in Scandinavia. I think it might have, but we also see on record that this process started before. It starts in the Merovingian period, but it might have enforced it in some way, I think.
So one thing that I came back across in your paper this morning when I was reading it again, and I can't find the note that I made for myself here, but you talk about, here it is, that the 6th century crisis has been, that scholars kind of tended to approach it in terms of collapse or, a dramatic change, but you see it more as being transitional, crisis as a transitional point, and I suppose it comes back to there, that what you're saying, that's the point of change at which we move from this pre-5th century towards what becomes the Viking Age with this stratified society. And I think you were heading towards that with what you were saying there, that it is that the 6th century is a process of transition rather than anything
that's,
else.
That's right.
Yeah,
I think so. That's my impression at all, after all. Yeah, I think you're right there, because this is quite, this collapse narrative, it's quite easy to grasp to, and it explains a lot in a way. So it's a kind of, but this collapse narrative is more like, we tend to focus on these big changes, and the collapse scenario is also kind of dramatic, it sparks interest and stuff. So too often you actually turn to it to explain things that are more complex when you look into it in detail. And that's also the thing, I think, with the 6th century, that all these major processes that people turn to when they're describing this kind of societal collapse they think happened is actually processes that started in the migration period. The changes in the settlement record started as early as the 4th century, for instance. The changes in weaponry started in the migration period. We also see that there are changes in agriculture starting now in the migration period and everything. And when we're contextualizing it with the dramatic events in the continent, with the fall of the Western Roman Empire and the migrations themselves, we get a more complex picture, which explains to us that the process, the society was already well underway towards something else when the 6th century cooling occurred. So it's not an explanation in itself. I think it's more like, a catalyst in some way. And the thing is, with these catalysts, they don't have to be that dramatic to have actually effect on societal development. Because as we discussed previously, thing with superstition, you don't always need that kind of dramatic depopulations and starvations and stuff for actually people to experience things as dramatical or critical. It's more the fear itself that needs to come into expression. And if there is fear, then you also have this idea of crisis. It's very well present in present day politics as well, for instance. I would tend to focus on crisis before actually crisis happens, you know? The Israeli philosopher Adi Ophir has described it as a kind of a process of catastrophization, when you kind of you prepare the human mind for something bad to happen, but to avoid it, you mobilize, you know, and to prevent it. And that's more or less actually, according to Ophir, and it's not necessarily a conscious process. It's more like something that is going on in the back of the people's heads, you know. And they are. It's and it affects the way we think about our future, but also how we perceive our present and the past. So I think when we're also discussing crisis and climate and such things in archaeology and history, we tend to actually kind of adopt these modern scenarios without actually critically approaching them first. As a kind of catastrophization, I think. That's not to say that these things are not real, because they are very much. But the way we think about them, the way we turn to them as easy explanations of quite difficult processes in the past, it tells perhaps more about ourselves in present-day societies than actually about the past societies. If that makes any sense.
it does. And that's
on this monologue.
We started by talking about how the collapse theory is really easy to grasp, and you know it's a nice neat theory, but that actually when you look into it, the changes are much more complex. And longer term, that change has been going on for a long time before these eruptions happen. And they look like they have a dramatic impact. Mm. But actually, the of course, you know, for the people who lived through them, they did have a dramatic impact on their lives. You know, if the sun is blocked out for days and weeks on end, that is, you know, that's pretty dramatic. We all know from the what's going on at the moment that our grasp of perspective and scale in the middle of a pandemic is maybe not as strong as we'd like it to be. We're all catastrophizing a bit at the moment.
Yeah, so it's my prediction that now there's a lot of climate focus in archaeology, but I guess in a decade or so, there's a lot more focus on pandemics and probably.
Yeah.
Because that's you know something that is emerging now as a possible threat for modern society. So
it's our current
crisis. I will see it actually in the 6th century research in Norwegian archaeology. People are starting to move slightly towards plague instead of cooling as an explanation for these changes. Because they start to realize that cooling itself is not a sufficient explanation. So they're like, okay, what's the next best suggestion? Okay, we'd have this pandemic and it's going.
It makes us focus.
I guess it's more focused on the just organic plague than we have on the cooling itself.
Okay.
Which, of course, also is a part of this 6th century crisis picture.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, about the plague, the Justinian plague, and kind of the interplay with the cooling and all the different factors that are going on at this point in time that leads to this?
There are many known instances throughout history that crop failure is followed by pandemics and diseases. Mm. It's actually not that strange at all. When you have famine, of course, people's health is reduced. And when people's health is reduced, you get more vulnerable to diseases. So actually, that's simple. So you see it over and over again in history, that this kind of climate change is followed by pandemics. But of course, if that to happen, you, of course, need crop failure as well. The cooling itself is not enough. But we have very good accounts of the Justinian plague in Mediterranean sources. So we do know it was critical and it was caused large upheavals in Constantinople, for instance. But we actually don't know how far north it spread. We have direct evidence from France and southern Germany, but we still lack evidence from Scandinavia. And we have no written accounts to actually tell us more about it either. But I guess it's probable that it reached there. But even if it did, it's still uncertain if it was just as critical as later plagues. It's kind of the same bacteria as the medieval Black Death, the Justinianic plague. But it's not it's a species, it's a different variant of the same species. We don't actually know if this older variant in the 6th century were equally mortal like the one we see in the medieval times. So it's still many uncertainties to take into account there as well. And even if it spread to Scandinavia, would it have been that critical? Because it is an agrarian society. We had no towns or anything at that time. It was only scattered farms throughout the country. So there were no urban settlements that could actually be kind of, how do you say it in English, a place of major outbreak. It's not an easy solution that either.
We were talking about the plague, about the Justinian plague, and you made the point that there are no urban centres in Scandinavia, so there's no place for outbreaks to spread rapidly because the population is dispersed, and that's something that
I have a lot of villages in Denmark. You have a lot of both in Denmark and some parts in Sweden. You have large settlements, so that's not perhaps urban, but still quite large settlements.
Yeah,
in Norway, we are in lack of them, except for a very few rare instances, like in southwestern Norway, for instance. We do have this one village called Forsandmoen, which actually display this kind of societal decline that we're expecting during the 6th century. But it's extremely rare. Most parts of the country only have these scattered farmsteads. The country wasn't that densely populated like it was in medieval times. We're talking about this transitional period, you know, in prehistory. I think it's an anthropologist, Anton Oliver Smith, he describes crisis as a window of opportunity. And that's kind of how I try to look at it myself as well. It's not necessarily a game changer if disaster happens, but it opens possibilities for powerful groups in society to benefit from it in some way or the other, either by consolidating their power or perhaps by grasping power, if they are a kind of emerging powerful group of some kind. That's also what I think we see in Scandinavia, because during the migration period, they have this, we're talking a lot about this emergence of the warrior aristocracy in Scandinavia due to migrations and warfare and increasing unrest. And also the Scandinavians and Northern European peoples, they picked up a lot of both experience and ideas for military organization from the Roman Empire. Mm. So it was a thriving military development at that time. But at the same time, we have this traditional land-owning elite throughout Scandinavia that had their power consolidated in their estates and their, their fields and their livestock and stuff. Mm-hmm. And in this, there is a growing conflict between the warrior aristocracy and the land-owning elite that might, during a time of crisis like, for instance, 6th century, they might be able to benefit from it and actually change the social structure or consolidate their power. And when we look in the archaeological record for late Iron Age and including the Viking Age, this is what we see is a warrior society by several means, you're talking about leaders with considerable military powers, for instance. We also see it in weaponry during this time, that it changes from a kind of collective fighting style to a more individualized fighting style, for instance, that is kind of favoring the able hero, like you also see from the sagas, for instance. So this suggests that we are moving towards a society that's more focused on the leader, the charismatic leader, which has great military powers. And he's able to get hegemonic control over areas instead of direct control through ownership, for instance. Mm-hmm. So that is a major difference between the early and late Iron Age in Scandinavia. And it seems like the 6th century might have been a catalyst or a window of opportunity, to use that phrase, mm-hmm. for these groups to actually really become the dominant power in the Iron Age societies. Mm-hmm. And in that case, if that happened, even areas that are quite well off during the cooling, like the Oslofjord area, for instance, might still be impacted by the event, but more indirectly. Because if the situation is creating unrest in certain parts of the country, in eastern Norway, for instance, it doesn't take much for it to affect them indirectly through warfare, for instance, or migrations.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess it's complex.
It is complex, but that's but human life is complex, no matter what we say or do. So I suppose just to wrap things up, what do you think is the most important thing we need to think about when we're looking at these moments of crisis, of change, of transition? You know, we need to move away from this one size fits all approach and look for more detail in the picture. Would you say, what do you think?
Yeah, at least we need to contextualize it better. And we need to have analytical frameworks that allow us to critically approach it and not just... My impression is that the current research is more about concurrency between scientific and archaeological records.
Okay.
And it's more kind of analogy than it actually analyzes. Because...
Yeah.
We think that it had to have an impact.
Okay.
That's the starting point for much of the 6th century research, I think.
Yeah.
So we're able to move on to actually create new knowledge instead of just doing storytelling, which it is, and actually bridge between concurrency and causation. We need to have a coherent analytical framework that allows it to actually know. Yeah, by contextualizing the evidence and actually trying to test it, to test the hypothesis on the archaeological record, we are able to move forward and get a more better and detailed picture of the development from the early to late Iron Age. And to be able to do so, I think we need to turn to vulnerability as a key concept.
Mm-hmm.
Because the starting point for any kind of research in vulnerability now is the context itself. It is all the details. It is the character of society that is important when you're studying vulnerability. So then we need to dive into these details and understand them. And we need to assess and define society. What are the possible dangers for this society? What are the possible threats to this society, for instance? How dependent are they on these and these factors? How robust are they, for instance? And when you start analyzing and disentangling society in that way, I think that archaeological record gives more sense in a way when discussing the 6th century.
Mm-hmm.
It explains, for instance, why you have these different trajectories in the western and eastern part of the country. Yes, I mean, as some parts have these traits, these patterns of crisis, while other doesn't. No?
I think we'll leave it there. That's gone really well. I think you've said a lot, and I think we've covered all the points that I kind of put in the email and covered the points that you made in return, talking about the variability and the complexity of the evidence, and that we need to have better frameworks, more grasp of the data, and of the detail, rather than just going for the big picture narrative, the big story. And I mean, the stories that we tell are, you know, they're great for grabbing attention. Like the story of the collapse in the 6th century is great. It's really it grabs attention. Or the comparison that I'd use here in Ireland is that we didn't have towns until the Vikings arrived. So the Vikings arrived and brought us our towns. But when you look at the evidence, actually, you know, they didn't really. but we didn't really have towns before then either. We had a couple of kind of early monastic settlements. We didn't even really have villages. So what happens when the Vikings arrive is actually much more complex, because we suddenly have these urban settlements. Or no, not plural, one. We have Dublin emerges within the first kind of 20 years of Vikings coming to raid and overwinter in Ireland. We have this dense urban settlement with the on the river, with the really typical boundaries, the long rectangular plots and the squared rectangular houses rather than round houses, which is the traditional, the typical Irish way of building. And it emerges practically overnight in the archaeological record. But it's only in Dublin, that's the only place we have evidence for it. And when we get our first settlement, a first urban settlement in Cork and Waterford, it's 200 years later. And again, it appears virtually overnight. It goes from nothing to a town in a couple of years. But it doesn't, the reality is, it doesn't happen just like that. There has to be a bigger story, a larger, more detailed narrative behind it. And we have to look for that before we can just say the Vikings gave us towns here in Ireland. So yeah, so that's what I'm
thinking. And you know, the Vikings were not good at towns either, you know?
Well, you see, this is it. There wasn't.
I mean, the Vikings, at least the Norwegian Vikings, weren't very good at building towns, because we hardly had any.
So it has to be a more complex story.
Of course,
than
in
that.
Denmark, the situation is quite different, and also in Sweden. At least there shouldn't be Norwegian Vikings, I think. It'd have to be Danes.
Yeah.
I think you summed it up quite well. But I also like to say that I think it's the important thing for future research on this kind of subject is actually to be able to combine the grand overall narrative with the context, with contingency, in a way. That is the main challenge, because I think both that the detailed perspective and context has great value, but also you need this grand narrative to be able to put it into this overall context as well. And these two approaches, which perhaps can be described as one qualitative and one quantitative, is quite different, but we need to try to combine them to actually move further. Otherwise, these data sets won't actually, how do you say it in English, speak to each other in any way. It will only give opposing trajectories. So we need to look on different scales at the same time, both at the details level, and we need to work on the grand scale at the same time, be able to put everything into its proper place, in a way. So I'm by no means against grand narratives, but we need to combine them with critical approaches.
Yeah, there's a place for everything. Okay. Brilliant. Thank you so much.
It's been very nice talking to you. So I wish you all the best with your research.